Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. The human papillomavirus is the virus that causes warts. It also causes cervical cancer and possibly other cancers. Are you aware that there's a vaccine that can prevent cervical cancers due to this virus? Our phone numbers are 550-8422 in Anchorage. Our outside toll-free number is 1-800-478-8255. You can email us at line1@aprn.org. Coming up next hour, we'll be talking about vaccines to prevent cervical cancer on Line One, your health connection.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. And by Providence Imaging Center, providing early detection of breast cancer with digital screening mammography and technologists with more than 170 years of combined experience. Information at provimaging.com.
Welcome to Line One, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's topic is the human papillomavirus and a vaccine that helps prevent cancers due to this virus. Our phone numbers are familiar to you if you listen to APRN's Talk of Alaska. In Anchorage, you can call 550-8422, 550-8422, and our toll-free number 1-800-478-8255. Also, you must know, if you've been listening to the program, you can email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at aprn.org. My guests today are Drs. Roz Singleton, Tom Hennessy, and Neil Murphy. All are from South Central Foundation here in Alaska. Welcome to each of you.
Thank you.
Before we get started, I'm going to take just a second to make my do my editorial a comment and remind our listeners that each year in the United States, influenza will cause about 35,000 extra deaths in the United States. If you look that up, that's about the same number of deaths that are due to automobile accidents each year. This year, besides the regular influenza or seasonal influenza, we're experiencing an extensive worldwide outbreak due to a new influenza virus called H1N1 or swine influenza. Deaths and hospitalizations due to all influenza are potentially preventable by vaccine. Yet it turns out that despite ample evidence of safety and effectiveness of this vaccine, many Americans are going unimmunized each year. Next week on Line One, we're going to provide our listeners with as reliable information as I can about the risk of influenza infection, as well as the risks and benefits of the vaccines that prevent these infections. So why don't you join us live or listen to the podcast so you can make an informed decision regarding immunization against this common infection. We're here today talking about another preventable disease with vaccines. That's cervical cancer and the human papillomavirus. Why don't we start with something simple and build up, which is my usual modus operandi. What's a vaccine and what's a virus?
Well, this is Dr. Hennessy, Thad. Thanks very much for having us here today. It's a great topic, and we're happy to be here. You kicked off talking about vaccinations, and we see vaccinations as one of the best ways to prevent disease. Vaccinations technically are like a pharmacologic preparation that's given to an individual to stimulate their immunity to protect them against a specific disease. And the word vaccination really derives from a Latin word, vacca, or stands for cow, and it really comes from the first use of vaccinations that we know about, which was to prevent smallpox. And it dates back to Edward Jenner in 1796, who used an observation that milkmaids who were taking care of cows and milking them, and if they got cowpox, they were protected against the smallpox disease. So we use that as an idea to inoculate those persons at risk with a small amount of cowpox, and then demonstrated afterwards that they were protected against smallpox, a related disease. So we've used that word vaccination to kind of go back to the history of the use of cows to produce the first vaccine. And in common language, vaccination and immunization really mean the same thing. They're those immunologic preparations or pharmacologic preparations used to get somebody's immune system boosted so they can be prevented against getting an illness without having to suffer the illness.
So in a sense, it's trying to stimulate the immune system without much risk, certainly much less risk than the natural illness
That's right. And if done right, they're safe and effective and produce maybe some discomfort at the time that the vaccination is given, but then produce long-lasting immunity that will prevent the person having to suffer through the infection that they're designed against.
My mind immediately jumps to all the concerns the population, most people have about vaccines. What can you maybe just summarize briefly the amount of effort that goes into testing vaccines to make sure that they're safe? What generally happens to assure the public or to assure those people who are given the vaccines that these things are safe?
There's four major phases of vaccine development. The first is the concept of, is this a vaccine-preventable disease? And not all diseases are vaccine-preventable, either because the bacteria is too diverse or technologically it's not able to get a vaccine. So the first is the concept. The second thing is to develop a potential agent. And oftentimes it's a protein that resides on the outside of the virus that we know that the body responds to. And then after that preliminary evaluation, then studies occur in animals looking at various models of vaccine, and that's called phase one studies, and then phase two studies in looking at safety primarily in humans, and then also getting an idea of dose. And those are in limited numbers of humans, and then those lead to larger studies in humans. And then a phase three study is a vaccine efficacy study, also looking at safety, and that looks at the effectiveness of the vaccine and the safety. And those studies are very large. The largest one recently was for rotavirus vaccine. It was 70,000 infants. So those are extremely large, trying to pick out the possibility of rare events and also look carefully at the effectiveness of the vaccine. And then the fourth phase is after licensure, then there's continued monitoring of the vaccine's effectiveness and then several means of monitoring vaccine safety.
So we really, in this country in particular, we continue to monitor that and even have some compensation situations related to whether some real vaccine complication has occurred.
Exactly.
There's a whole system built around vaccine monitoring after licensure. One is the physicians can report adverse events that occur in persons who received a vaccine. That's called the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAERS. And then there's some large linked systems between HMO systems in the United States that represent a different geographic regions where their data for their providers and their patients are all linked together in the vaccine safety data system, and that links those together, and so we can look for abnormal signals in symptoms like arm pain or fever or other things that might be related to the vaccine. So those are very active processes that continue long after the licensure of a vaccine to ensure its safety.
All right, so human papillomavirus is the virus that appears to really be causative in cervical cancer. What is a virus, and what do we know about this particular virus, Neil?
This particular one is a double-stranded DNA virus. There's actually a large group. There's 100 different HPV vaccines, of which 30 are related to genital illness. 13 of those are high risk for cervical cancer. So we worked from that concept, and we looked at the protein on the outside of that virus, and that's how the actual vaccine started.
So the epidemiology is the study of what happens to this infection, and we know that it's a very common virus that can cause common warts, but it also causes genital infections, of which those genital infections, some of those go on to cervical cancer, and it's been clarified which strains of the 100 and so forth there are that will cause those cancers. And so that's what the vaccine's been designed primarily against is, what is it, number 16 and 18, which are the really bad actors in these viruses, is that right?
If you had a vaccine that worked against those two, you could theoretically prevent 70% of cervical cancers. 16 is probably the largest in the United States, a single number, and then 18 to a lesser extent. But, those two are the two top.
I know kids, as a pediatrician, get warts all the time. I assume this virus is pretty prevalent. It's all over the place.
Right. And this vaccine would prevent 90% of cervical – or excuse me, of genital warts.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So warts can happen not only just on your skin, but they may happen in the genital area on boys and girls.
Right. And unfortunately, as a gynecologist, I run into this a fair amount. I actually have to take patients, the younger patients, like a year old, 18 months old, to the operating room and use a laser to remove it because it's hard to remove those from a small child like that without general anesthesia. So that's a big event in that child's life.
So how do we know real well or what evidence do we have that the vaccines are going to prevent the cancer that is associated with infection with types 16 and 18, for example? How do we gather that information?
I'm going to take that.
Yeah, we gathered that through actual the studies that Roz described. It was really phase 2 and phase 3. We actually had a number of different vaccines that we tried, and we failed, frankly, for 15 years. Mm-hmm. And we tried and tried again, and finally we were able to come up with this one that really worked on, again, on the proteins on the outside of the vaccine, and put it into small studies and then to slightly larger studies. And amazingly enough, it turned out to be virtually 100% effective.
Yeah, and my understanding is one of the more effective vaccines there is. How is this vaccine transmitted, and who is getting it, and then how does that lead to policies about who should receive the vaccine?
Oh, the vaccine itself?
Mm-hmm.
The vaccine was licensed in 2006 by the FDA, and then it went through a process of recommendation by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which is a national committee that makes recommendations for vaccines that are in the United States. And the ACIP, or the Advisory Committee, recommended routine vaccination of all girls at age 11 to 12 years of age, with catch-up vaccine up through the licensure age of 26, and then vaccination licensed as low as age 9. So the vaccine's licensed for girls age 9 through 26, and then recommended by the ACIP for girls routinely at age 11 to 12. A recent development is in recommendations for boys, which is a very current issue that recently recommended by the FDA panel for licensure in boys. And the ACIP, or the advisory committee, is going to review the evidence and make a decision on recommendations in their meeting in October, so this month.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. We're talking about human papillomavirus, a cause of cervical cancer, and a vaccine that's now been available for a couple of years. If you've got questions or comments, there's a couple of ways to get a hold of us. In Anchorage, dial 550-8422. That's our direct line here in Anchorage, 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. And you can email us at line1@APRN.org. Just a reminder, we also will repeat this program as a tape rebroadcast between 8 and 9, and we won't be here then. So if you've got questions, you've got till just a little bit before 3 o'clock Anchorage time to call and ask questions. So how did we come up? Why 9, 10, 11, 12? I mean, that's often a question that parents are struggling with. Why such a young age? What is it we know about this virus and how it's spread that leads us to want to do it at such a young age, since everybody seems to know it's sexually transmitted?
Right. And one of the things we have found in the testing is that it's more effective in those patients who have not been sexually active. It still does work in patients who have been sexually active, but it's much more effective before sexual debut. So that's why it was chosen between 11 and 12 years of age. I run into this a lot in the patients as they get older, and I can encourage patients to take it, but it's just not nearly as effective.
The other thing about the age is that 11 and 12 is the age of routine adolescent vaccines. And there's some other vaccines that adolescents are routinely recommended to receive at that adolescent visit. One very important one is the tetanus vaccine, which is now TDAP and protects adolescents not only against tetanus and diphtheria, but also against pertussis. And then a second vaccine is the meningococcal vaccine. So this was chosen also as the age, just because this is the routine adolescent visit when we recommend other adolescent health measures, including vaccination.
Neil, you mentioned that it's important that the evidence is it works better before you become sexually active, but you didn't explain why that might be the case.
I didn't. And I think part of it is that the patients who become sexually active very quickly after initiation of sexual activity will become exposed to HPV very quickly. I mean, what we've actually found studies, for instance, in the college-age women, where within the first 18 months of sexual activity initiation, as many as 60% of those patients will have HPV. So I think that's one of the things is that HPV is just very effective at infecting the host.
Mm-hmm. And it's also, I guess, clear, just even though it's very infectious, it's very common, once you start being sexually active, you're getting exposed. It doesn't mean you're going to be exposed to the strains that are associated with cancer. But we really don't have a good way to tell what you're exposed, strains you're being exposed to. Is that right?
That's correct. And the current over-the-counter test that we can do during a Pap smear is just a generic test for the 13 subtypes. It doesn't tell you which one exactly it was.
Mm-hmm. So the reason, again, and this seems to me is a critical issue, the starting and recommending this vaccine early is you don't know when you're going to get this virus when you become sexually active. But when you become sexually active, your risks go up very quickly of acquiring that vaccine. And once you've been infected, the vaccine is no longer effective against that particular serotype.
Right. And the last part, we're trying to work with that a little more. We don't know completely. Some patients may actually clear the virus. Probably as much as 90% of patients will clear it if they're less than 26 years of age. So we don't know to what extent will they be protected against the next time they get 16 or 18. That's still unanswered.
So, yeah, for the public that are listening to that, the question is how long does the vaccine protection last? And you're addressing that in studies, and the issue is we don't know, probably, because it's going to take a while to answer that question.
We do know that it has a good or a very effective ratio up until about 6 years out. So our studies do go 6 years out. It probably, for the people in the public, they would be best if they considered this similar to the hepatitis vaccine. It has about the same level of protection up to about 5 or 6 years as the hepatitis vaccine had shown. Now, we don't have studies beyond that, but in the hepatitis vaccine, we do show a long-term effect.
Is it being used in other countries around the world, and do we have any specific data on decrease in cervical cancer rates that are thought to be a consequence of this vaccine? Yeah.
There's over 100 countries in which HPV vaccine is licensed. There's actually two HPV vaccines. One, Gardasil, is licensed in this country and is used routinely. And then there's another vaccine that covers the two types that cause cervical cancer, and that's licensed in several countries also. It's still a ways away from looking at the efficacy, although the initial efficacy studies have shown, and those are ongoing with follow-up, have shown a significant decrease in precancer lesions, and that has continued after the period of the study. So those studies showed almost 100% decrease in precancer lesions in the group that got the vaccine, and then those ongoing reviews of the of that study have showed continued protection.
But the lag time between time of infection and a precancer and then cancer forming is 10 to 15 years. Mm-hmm. And so we don't really have enough time where the vaccines have been in use to really see the drop in cervical cancer we'd like to see. Mm-hmm. In the U.S. in 2008, there were 12,000 women who were diagnosed with cervical cancer and 4,000 deaths. And we would like to see that number come way down. In Alaska, on average, about 25 women every year are diagnosed with cervical cancer. And so there's still quite a burden of illness there. And in the developing world, it's an even larger problem. Over 500,000 cervical cancers every year diagnosed in the developing world or worldwide, and 260,000 deaths. So it's a huge worldwide burden. And the fact that other countries have licensed this and are using the vaccine routinely is encouraging. There's also an effort to get the vaccine out through the Global Alliance for Vaccine Initiatives. And so they're trying to provide donor support to get the vaccine in use in the developing world, where women are even at a worse situation because there isn't routine pap smear screening and the kind of preventive and treatment programs we have in place in the U.S. So we expect to see this vaccine in use worldwide.
So to kind of put cervical cancer in some kind of frame of reference, there's actually been a one of these cancers that there's been a dramatic, as I understand it, decrease in the prevalence of that problem because of the availability and the public's knowledge of getting pap smears. Mm-hmm. However, the issue is that's expensive and not available to everybody, although very well in this country, and that the relative safety and efficacy of the vaccine makes it make sense to continue to push something, even though we have an effective program already. This is just amplifies the benefit.
Well, and especially there's a large burden of illness that is not cervical cancer. The mm-hmm. precancerous lesions affect a huge amount of our patients. In fact, the vast majority, and it leads to anxiety, leads to small surgeries, colposcopies, follow-up. Mm-hmm. So that is really, if we could make any kind of inroads there, then many of our patients would be well-served.
So what you're saying is many women who are doing their pap smears on a regular basis, and I have to admit I don't know if it's yearly or how often and under what in what situation, you may want to define that. But anyway, they come in, get them, and then they may get a result which is suggestive of a precancerous lesion that may need to go to further interventions to try to prevent development. And clearly, if you could prevent cervical cancer, the infection that causes these things from starting in the first place, you can obviate all that worry and expense.
Right. And we literally, at one day, I'll just do colposcopy just all day long.
And colposcopies are?
That's where we look at the patient's cervix with a microscope and a real bright light, and we take biopsies, and then we send them to the pathologist, and 3 to 5 days later, I can call the patient with some kind of indicator she has precancer and if she needs further testing.
What else is of benefit? This can prevent apparently certain kinds of genital warts. Is there the potential there for other preventative kinds of advances with this vaccine?
Well, there are other GYN cancers that are linked to this to this virus as well. About 40% of vaginal neoplasia and penile cancers are also linked to HPV, and so those are potentially preventable through use of this vaccine. And then a large proportion of the head and neck tumors are also connected to HPV infection. So there's potential benefits that go beyond cervical cancer for the use of the vaccine. And then we talked about genital warts also. In one of the formulations has the two types of HPV genotypes that cause 90% of genital warts, which although they're not dangerous in terms of cancer forming, they cause quite a lot of headache for young women and young men alike, and would be better off if they didn't have to suffer through that.
Why hasn't the vaccine been promoted for boys and men yet?
And that's really more of a cost-effectiveness issue and studies. And because cervical cancer is the number one cost and number one morbidity from HPV, then the initial studies on HPV were in women for that reason. Then after those studies were initiated, studies on boys and young men were started, and those studies are ongoing and completed. And actually, in this month, the ACIP is making a decision on whether to recommend Gardasil for boys. So that's an ongoing issue.
There's actually over 40 countries that have licensed one of these two formulations of the HPV vaccine for use in boys and men. Typically, though, they don't support them programmatically with funding or extra infrastructure to help get the vaccine to men and boys, but it is available to them. And that's been an approach taken in the UK and in Australia alike. In the U.S., there's a funding infrastructure for vaccines that covers a lot of people who are young women who will receive HPV vaccine. And the decision whether to license the vaccine for boys and men and then to support it with funding are really two separate decisions.
First and foremost, although there's no a priori reason why it won't be safe and effective for boys, you really have to show it's safe and effective for boys before the FDA is going to approve it, even though it's the same vaccine, it's just different sex. I suspect that that's true.
Right, and the FDA has voted on this, but the ACIP, or the advisory committee, is the one who's meeting this month.
Okay. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. You call 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255, and you can email us at line1@aprn.org. After this short break, we'll continue to take any calls and talk with Dr. Roz Singleton, Tom Hennessy, and Neil Murphy of South Central Foundation about the vaccine to prevent cervical cancer. On Line 1, your health connection, I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1, your health connection, comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Lakota's Pharmacy. Walk in or drive through for medical equipment, support hose, and supplements. On Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, the pharmacy with the wheelchair on the sign. Providence, Alaska, combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are Dr. Roz Singleton, who is not really with the South Central Foundation. She's with the Alaska Native Health Consortium, and Tom Hennessy of the CDC, and Neil Murphy, who happens to be with South Central Foundation. So I wanted to clarify that. We're talking about vaccines that prevent cervical cancer, particularly the virus that does that, it appears, which is called human papillomavirus. If you have questions or comments, you can email us directly before 3 o'clock at line1@aprn.org. You can give us a call at 550-8422. Outside of Anchorage, it's 1-800-478-8255. And remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 on KSKA, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. I've stressed a number of times on the program that if we're going to make healthcare decisions, both as providers and as patients, we want to understand what's the risks and what's the benefits. We've been talking about how this illness occurs, how the vaccines work, what we know about the efficacy of the vaccine. Now let's talk about risks. Patients always would like us to say that there are no risks, and I keep telling them, that's not the way it works. There's always some risk to everything. So what do we need to know about the risk of this vaccine?
Probably the highest risk is through sexual activity. The early onset of sexual activity, the number of total partners are probably the single two highest risk factors. There are other risk factors.
That's for acquiring the infection.
To acquiring HPV infection.
Right.
It's also associated with previous sexually transmitted diseases, for instance, chlamydia or gonorrhea. Mm-hmm. Actually, smoking can actually potentiate the disease. In other words, once you get the HPV and if you smoke, then you may keep it longer. Another factor is low socioeconomic status. In one study, in the county that had over 20% of poverty, they had twice the rate of cervical cancer. So, yes, there are specific patient-related risks that they could change to avoid this.
Yeah, Neil, you started talking about the risk of acquiring the HPV. I'd ask about the vaccine, but I think you brought up a very good point, and the point I wanted to get to and had forgotten about is, isn't it also true that just because you get, let's say, serotype 16 infection doesn't mean you're going to get cervical cancer? There are confounding or cofactors that maybe we don't quite understand yet.
Yeah, in fact, it's very unlikely that you'll actually get cervical cancer. The biology is almost 90% of patients will clear it.
Okay.
So they stand a chance if they continue their pap smear screening and they don't smoke cigarettes, then they really do stand a chance to clear this completely.
Mm-hmm. However, there's still quite a bit of cervical cancer, so
right.
For reasons that may not be entirely clear, there's reasons to want to try to prevent this infection.
Right.
Now, let's talk about the vaccine. What about risk of the vaccine?
The other side, for the vaccine, about 1 in 10 people who get the vaccine will have a mild fever. About 1 in 30 will get some itching where they get the vaccine and soreness or redness. And about 1 in 60 will get a moderate fever. And these are known and well-documented side effects after a number of vaccines. This is very similar to other vaccines. As well as with other adolescent vaccines, there's a certain risk of fainting or syncope after the vaccine that is related to not to the vaccine component, but to the act of getting a shot.
And age.
Right? Yeah. And we all know that.
A six-month-old is not going to faint, but a teenager will.
Right. Teenagers sometimes faint after vaccines. The good thing, and there have been several reports, unfortunately, some of serious events happening after syncope or fainting, but this is a preventable occurrence. And what we recommend that providers do, whenever they give a vaccine, a shot, or do a procedure on an adolescent, is to have them sit down or lay down for at least 15 minutes after receiving the shot. So those are known complications after the vaccine have been very well studied.
That's all?
There's also, as we mentioned, there's a national reporting system, mm-hmm. the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, and then the Vaccine Data Link system that's the more active monitoring. And the Vaccine Safety Data Monitoring System, the Data Link system, has not shown any significant differences from other vaccines in side effects. The Journal of American Medical Association recently had a summary of a review of the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System. And this is the system where anyone can report any side effect or any adverse event or event occurring after any vaccine at any period of time. So there are any events, and it's possible to report anything that may or may not be attributable to the vaccine. Some things that have been reported for this vaccine as well as other vaccines and that were evaluated carefully in the JAMA article were very rare events like Guillain-Barré syndrome. And the risk of Guillain-Barré was studied very carefully and not felt to be different than in the general population. So there was no increased risk. And then one other event that was evaluated was the risk of thrombus accidents like pulmonary embolism. And the risk of pulmonary embolism was higher because the vaccine is given to a group of girls and young women that may have other risk factors. However, for most of those events, there were other risk factors attributable, and that's being followed carefully, but it appears that those events occurred because of other risk factors such as smoking and using contraceptives. So those were some of the things that have been shown in the Vaccine Adverse Events Monitoring System. The JAMA article conclusion was that the adverse events reported through the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System do not give any trigger that would make having any more caution of this vaccine than others, and that the safety was clarified and continues to be recommended and felt to be a safe vaccine.
You know, that, well, let me structure the next question this way. What are the reasons commonly given by families, and I'm going to assume that this is mainly mothers for their daughters, not to get the vaccine? Do we know? I mean, there's a couple of issues being addressed here in that question. One's the unspoken comment that a lot of people who should be getting it aren't getting it. And then why is that true? And then why is that true? What do we know about the reasons they're not getting it?
I think we've done some work around this mm-hmm. area with some focus groups with mothers and mm-hmm. interviews with teenagers as well. And I think there's a lot of general concerns about vaccines that any parent would ask. Is the vaccine safe? Is it effective? Will my child be harmed? And I think parents are asking those questions about any vaccine that they're about to receive. So those are natural and good questions for parents to ask. And that's the – when we've talked to parents and really tried to get at their main concerns related to HPV, that's the main thrust of it. Parents are also very interested in protecting their daughters against cancer. And this is one of the – two vaccines that we have that can prevent cancer, the other one being hepatitis B, which can prevent liver cancer. And so there's a real intergenerational need to protect the young girls, and that's the main concern parents are coming across with. They're having concerns raised mainly in the press, I think, about parents concerned that perhaps if their daughter's vaccinated against HPV, they might become more sexually active. And we just in Alaska have not seen any indication that parents are very concerned about that or that there's really any evidence of behavioral change in teenagers when we talk to them. So I think that's been mainly stirred up in the media and not necessarily very well carried as a concern throughout the general public.
Maria, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, I have two things. First, I seek my medical needs at South Central Foundation, and I went to get a Gardasil shot, and they had me go out in town and pay out of pocket for it, and it was a pretty steep bill to pay. It was $100-some-odd for the shot.
Right.
And then a second thing I had a question about is if you already have human papillomavirus, does a shot do anything for you?
Okay, so one of the questions is easy to answer is, and we'll ask our guess here is about the vaccine. Does it help if you've already had HPV infection? Well, maybe not such an easy question to answer, but there's some general ideas there. But then, and then the other question specifically was, why does it cost so much, or why is it you have to pay for it if you work for South Central Foundation, or both of those?
Well, the vaccine is expensive. It's over $120 a dose. The state, through federal funding, through the Vaccine for Children's program, provides the vaccine free to persons who are less than 19 years of age, who fit in the VFC criteria, which include American Indian Alaska Native girls and Medicaid-eligible girls and uninsured girls and underinsured girls who receive their care at federally qualified health centers. So that's a small, actually in this, in our state, that's a significant proportion of girls. Outside of those recommendations for women older than 18, Merck has a program for underinsured low-income women that we've also tried to use to make vaccine accessible to a larger group of women. But that has been one of the issues that's affected the uptake of the vaccine.
I'm very well aware of all that. However, I am a beneficiary of the IHS, and I just don't know why I was sent out in town to pay out of pocket when mm-hmm. Maybe I didn't qualify for the Merck.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. In fact, I totally agree with Maria, and this has been a frustration on my part. There's kind of a notch group of patients who are in her situation, and Roz and I actually have talked about this in the last week and how to address that. It's because of the high cost of the vaccine that we have to go through this, you know, pharmacy and therapeutics committee. So we're going to now readdress that, and especially now that Maria's brought it up, we it's come up a number of times.
Yeah, and just to make it clear to those other listening, it's not just $120 a dose. Right. I mean, for one dose, it's three doses.
Mm-hmm.
And in the private sector, it's more like $150, $160. Now, some insurance companies are paying for that, and so there are other options. But the cost is clearly an issue, unfortunately. Now, back to the medical question here is, what if you've already had an infection with HPV? You know you've had some problem with HPV. Can you still get the vaccine, and would it help?
Yes. We do not recommend that folks go and get screened for HPV before they get this vaccine. They should just get the vaccine based on their age and demographics, unrelated to their previous pap smear status. If they have had previous abnormal pap smears, there could have been any of 30 different varieties of HPV strain that caused it, not necessarily the two that are in the vaccine. So we do recommend that they get the vaccine regardless of their previous HPV or abnormal pap smear status.
So there's no risk to getting the vaccine even if you've been infected. It doesn't change the risk. It's just you don't know how effective it's going to be. So back to balancing risk and benefit.
Exactly.
Right. There's four types in the vaccine, and it's possible somebody had been exposed to one but not the other three, and so there still could be some benefit derived.
Okay. Maria, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Leslie, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, first of all, I wanted to say this is an amazing program today. I have three daughters between the ages of 9 and 18, and when I've tried to get information about my primary concern has been the safety and the potential side effects, and I found that the information available is very much tied up in the debate that you spoke about between among people who fear that getting the vaccine somehow leads to, promiscuity. And that isn't a concern of mine. I just do want to protect my children. Basically, my question was about side effects either now or in the future. Are there any potential future side effects or issues down the road from this vaccine? And also, how many doses are required? I thought it was just one shot, but I thought a moment ago I heard you say three.
Yeah, Michelle, there's three doses, or Leslie, I'm sorry, three doses are for sure what's recommended at this particular time. And just an editorial comment about there are tremendous numbers of myths out there about all vaccines. Be very, very careful about where you're going to get information. And that's all I can say. I mean, it's a huge hamper. There's a large section of the population who really are anti-vaccine for lots of reasons, and a lot of misconceptions out there. A general tenet of medicine is that you never want to give anybody a treatment that's worse than their illness, and nobody is going to be recommending a vaccine where the risk is greater than the illness. And lots and lots and lots and lots of money is being spent to make sure that these vaccines are safe and effective. It doesn't mean there won't be a problem, doesn't mean there won't be a risk, but it wouldn't be marketed if it wasn't felt that the vaccine was far more safe than what you're trying to prevent and also works.
Ross, maybe you want to talk about the dosing schedule a bit and about what we know about side effects.
Yeah, the vaccine dosing is at time zero and then 2 months later, then 6 months for the last dose of the vaccine. Like most vaccines, if you're late getting the second or third dose, you don't need to get another dose. You just get it when you're ready, and your immune system responds even if you're late in getting a dose. So that's the recommendation for dosing. And it is important to try to evaluate carefully the safety of the vaccine. And this vaccine has been evaluated probably more than other vaccines in the recent past. And the evaluation has shown that it's been a safe vaccine. There's no biological plausible side effect that I can imagine that's outside the realm of what's being evaluated right now. And usually you can look at what could be potential side effects from a vaccine. The people who evaluate vaccines are very cautious. And, in fact, vaccines have been withdrawn from the market in the past when there was any signal that there was potential side effects that were significant. So there's careful assessment of that. Tom, do you want to add anything to
that? I was just going to say that the side effects that we noticed about noted about arm pain at the injection site and some itching and perhaps a little bit of fever have been reported. They're all within the window immediately following the vaccination, so within the first 72 hours. And there haven't been any long-term side effects. And I think, Leslie, that was your question initially, was is there any long-term risk associated with the vaccine? And nothing that's been reported and connected to the vaccine.
Or that we'd imagine.
One last, one last question is, I do have one of my children on a dose of birth control pills for an underlying medical condition. And is there any additional risk to that child?
No, there aren't any additional risks by taking a combination oral contraceptive agent.
There are two groups of people that wouldn't get the vaccine, and those are pregnant women and persons who have a demonstrated yeast allergy. Those would be people for whom the vaccine would be not indicated.
Well, thanks for answering my questions, and I can't tell you how helpful this has been, because this is an issue I have really wondered over for, you know, since the vaccine became available, and I have found it very difficult to get good information, even, you know, I think probably because it's so new, even from some of our medical providers. So I really think.
If you want to get, definitely you want to get some good information, there's some links on our website, kska.org/line1, that will get you to some more information you can read about that's reliable. So good
Thank
luck.
Thank you.
You bet. Michelle, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I just had a quick question. I'm 28 years old, and if I remember right from the Gardasil ads and some of the other information I've read, I believe I'm just over the demographic window. Should I still pursue getting the shot, or have I totally missed my opportunity, and would it be kind of null and void if I tried?
This is a great question. I'm anxious to hear the answer.
Well, I'll just mention it. I'm going to let Neil follow up, but I'll just mention that there are studies right now in 27 to 44-year-old women looking at efficacy and cost-benefit of the vaccine. And it's all related to, you know, whether the risk of potentially having HPV prior to getting the vaccine. And Neil, do you want to answer further?
Well, yeah, at this point, the vaccine is licensed to the age of 26, and it's approved by the ACIP to that age. It's so if one did take it after 26, they'd be using it as an off-label indication. And I think within probably 2 years, we're going to know more about this other vaccine that Roz has talked about. In fact, there was initially a question of whether they're going to actually try to get it approved to the age of 55. So this 44 is even one cut from there. So rather than taking a vaccine that's off-label, I would suggest we wait until we get that GlaxoSmithKline product out and see how that's going to be ultimately licensed.
Michelle,
great. That helps so much. Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Yeah, just an editorial comment.
Yeah.
My privilege here. I think this is a great question. First off, let's address the off-label use. This is something I want to make sure everybody understands, that the FDA, who licensed these vaccines, is licensing it and is controlling what pharmaceutical companies can tell physicians what they can do with this vaccine or what's been shown to be safe and effective. It doesn't mean in any way that it's illegal to use that vaccine off-label, okay? Because there are a lot of people who will never have studies done, pregnant women and kids for lots, so pediatricians face this every day. And there's no a priori reason to think that it's dangerous to give anybody this vaccine. It's not going to – there's no increased risk of any problem. And so you might find physicians that would be more than happy to give you that vaccine. You're just going to have trouble paying for it by anybody. Insurance companies are going to dodge it for sure, but if you want to pay out of pocket. And the reason I think this is important, I have older daughters that I've encouraged to get the vaccine. I think it's worthwhile and there's not much risk to it, but that's my editorial comment.
Well, I just kind of wondered why 25 or 26.
Right.
It's because that's where
I wondered if that was when you were still young and I guess before you were more sexually active or something like that, but I just thought, you know, I am part of a generation that, you know, is much later in life before they're getting married and having children, and it just seems like by the time you're done with your master's, you're 26. And
yeah,
like,
right. Well, if you've never been sexually active, I'm just saying then it would make all even more sense. But the fact that number's in there because that's what the studies were done on, and that's what the FDA has given permission for companies to say it's safe and effective for.
Right, and the FDA will not make recommendations outside the age that a vaccine is studied. They're very careful, and same with the ACIP, so that's where we end up with age cutoffs.
But it's probably unlikely that somebody on their 27th birthday would be very different in their response to this vaccine or the way that it would
work.
Well,
I mean, that's generally true in pediatrics, although people argue all the time that kids aren't little adults. But in general, the medications we use in adults are pretty safe in kids. It's just not been shown to be safe and effective in that age group. Anyway, thanks for your call, Michelle.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Yep. So we'll take another caller. Mary, you're on line one. Mary, you still with us? Must have lost Mary. Okay, where are we? We're talking about vaccine safety a little bit. What about, let me give you a for instance that may get me in trouble with you guys. I get the question of a mother comes in and says, I have a daughter who is 11, and should I get the vaccine now? Should I have her get the vaccine now? And here is my response, and I need to know if I'm right or wrong, or how would you argue this? I said, look, are you very certain your daughter is not sexually active? And if you can say that with pretty good assurance, then why not delay it until we see if we get better vaccines, cheaper vaccines, more effective vaccines?
Well, the answer I give moms is, yes, vaccinate them now.
And how do you know?
Because how do you know that you're going to come back and get revaccinated? And unfortunately, studies show that people often don't come back and return for a vaccine. So that would be my response.
You missed your opportunity.
You've missed your opportunity.
Good argument.
And the studies now show that the vaccine efficacy seems like it's going to be years and years. So I think technology can come down the road, but I would expect that it's going to be several years before we have significant advances in technology. So that's my response. Yep. Neil, do you have a question?
Yeah, and we also watch these vaccines over time. In fact, we're doing a study at the tribal consortium. We're going to watch how this vaccine plays out over time. We're going to make sure that if you knock down number 16 and number 18, that number 31 and number 33 don't pop up.
Sure.
So it is part of an ongoing system, not just looking at complications, but how well this vaccine works. And we have in the past taken other vaccines off our formulary that we didn't think worked and replaced them with ones that did. So there may be better vaccines, and if that's the case, then we would encourage the next vaccine to be used.
We've got an email that I think is worth going through. It's going to take a little time. We've got about 5 minutes, and I'll remind everybody. My stepdaughter's mother refuses to allow her 17-year-old daughter to get a vaccine, to get the vaccine. She cites the following reasons. One, her daughter does not have a maternal family history of cervical or any other cancer. Two, it's far better to allow the body to be naturally exposed to whatever illnesses and disease that might be prone, since we're not all prone to every illness, and let the various levels of immune system fight the virus or bacteria through the mouth, lungs, nostril, eye exposure, rather than injecting a germ or partial germ directly into the body or bloodstream, which bypasses and depresses the natural immune system. The last part of that sentence is just not true. I'll state that already. Three, mother's immune system created an immunity to it from her previous exposure to HPV, and these antibodies and immunity are probably passed on to her daughter during the 3-plus years she was nursed. There's a number of misconceptions here to let you guys address these. First one is, what about no family history of cancer?
I'm really glad you brought that up. There's no family history relationship with cervical cancer. There are with other types of female cancers, but not with cervical cancer. Cervical cancer is essentially related to HPV exposure. And also the breastfeeding issue, this particular practice was really helpful for probably some certain respiratory antibodies early in life, but does not confer any kind of long-term benefit to children for HPV immunity.
Okay. What about it's better to let the body be exposed to natural illnesses rather than injecting the germ or directly into the bloodstream and bypassing the natural immune system?
Well, we found out with smallpox that allowing people to get natural smallpox was not a good idea. And smallpox has been eradicated in the world through vaccination.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make sense. We're getting rid of cancer by doing this. Obviously, our immune system didn't work very well. We're able to prevent it by better biology and better science.
Yeah, and with this vaccine, it's not the germ that's being injected into somebody either. It's right. the code of the virus. There's actually no DNA of the virus. It can't replicate. There's no way you could get an infection through this. So I think the concern that somehow there's a germ being injected is completely inaccurate.
And finally, the mother's immune system has created an immunity from her mother's exposure to HPV, and this was passed on to her daughter during the 3+ years she was nursed.
Any benefit from breastfeeding is usually during the first three months of life and maybe up through 6 months of life, but that benefit does not continue.
And most of those are antibodies. Those antibodies have about a 90-day half-life. They're destroyed. The children don't acquire lifelong immune cells that continue to remember that immunity, or we wouldn't have to have any vaccinations at any time, and kids would never get any infections that moms had ever had. So that doesn't make sense either. So those aren't good questions, or aren't reliable reasons not to get the vaccine.
They may be common questions.
But they're misunderstanding. There's so much, again, misunderstanding and of how the immune system works and people saying things that just aren't right, not true. All right, we have less than a minute. And this has worked fast. There's been a lot of good information at the end. What's the message we want to give and leave? I always want to what do we want people to remember from this hour?
We really encourage young women to take this vaccine. It's 100% effective and is very safe.
Okay. Any other comments?
Well, I think it's just an exciting time when we can offer to young women a chance to be protected against cervical cancer. And I think we shouldn't pass that opportunity up as parents and as good citizens.
And although the vaccine is effective against 4 types of HPV, HPV can still occur, so pap smears are still recommended.
Ah, good point. You know, it's not we're not at the point yet where we have to drop our guard about
right.
other potential serotypes, I guess is the best way mm-hmm. to put it at this time, that may be causing it that aren't in the vaccine. So we need to keep that in remember. And just for further reassurance, hopefully that the vaccines are safe. I have 2 daughters that have received the vaccine already, ages 16 and 18. All right. Our thanks to Dr. Roz Singleton, Dr. Tom Hennessy, and Dr. Neil Murphy, all from here in Anchorage. Line 1 will return next week. My guests will be Dr. William Schaffner of Vanderbilt College of Medicine and Dr. Ward Holbert. He's the new director of the State Division of Public Health. We're going to be discussing another vaccine and going through this risk-benefit ratio again. What's the risk of getting influenza, and what's the risk and benefits of the vaccine? Why don't you join us? Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. Stroke is an emergency. Providence, Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headaches without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.